Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of The Yellow Admiral by Patrick O'Brien, narrated by Patrick Tull.
Chapter 1. Sir Joseph Blaine, a heavy, yellow-faced man in a suit of grey clothes and a flannel waistcoat, walked down St. James's Street, across the park, and so to the Admiralty, which he entered from behind, opening the private door with a key and making his way to the large, shabby room in which he had his official being. He looked over the papers on his desk, nodded, and touched the bell. "If Mr. Needham is in the way, pray show him up," he said to the answering clerk. He half rose as Needham appeared and waved him to a comfortable chair on the other side of the desk. "Having finished with poor Delaney," he said, "we now come to another gentleman of whom we have no news. Stephen Maturin. Dr. Stephen Maturin. Perhaps our most valuable adviser on Spanish affairs." "I don't think I've heard his name."
"I don't suppose you have.
Yet you and your people have quite certainly found his cipher at the foot of many a cogent report. When he is going up and down in the world on our behalf, as he so often does," Sir Joseph stifled an "or did," and carried on, "he almost invariably sails with Captain Aubrey, whose name is no doubt familiar." "Oh, certainly," said Needham, who wished to make a good impression on this formidable figure, but whose talents didn't really lie in that direction. "The gentleman who was so unfortunate at the Guildhall trial." This reference to Captain Aubrey's stand in the pillory didn't seem to be well received, and to remedy the situation, Needham added a knowing, "son to the notorious General Aubrey." "If you wish," said Sir Joseph coldly. "Yet he might also be described as the officer who, commanding a 14-gun brig, took a 32-gun Spanish Zeebeck frigate and carried her into Mahon in the year 1, who cut out the French frigate Diane in a boat attack on the heavily guarded port of Saint-Martin, and who, most recently, returning with his squadron from a most active cruise against slavery in the Gulf of Guinea, utterly frustrated the French descent on the south of Ireland, driving a line of battleship on the rocks, to say nothing of—" "Yes, Mr. Carling," this to a secretary. "The pardons, sir, engrossed at last," said Carling, laying them on Sir Joseph's desk. "Those you asked for particularly are on top." He made his usual ghost-like exit. Sir Joseph glanced at their effective date, well before Maturin's departure for Spain, nodded, and went on, "To revert to Dr. Maturin, for whom we here are particularly concerned, and on behalf of whom we should value any assistance your people can give us, one of these," holding up a parchment, "refers to him. You probably know more about the late Duke of Havagstall than I do, the kind of men he privately mixed with, and the creatures he employed for some of his activities. We have a very great deal of material, and the creatures, as you so justly call them, were the immediate cause of his self-murder." "Yes." Blaine paused and said, "I will not make a long story of it with circumstantial details, but only observe that he had conceived a hatred for Maturin, who had been the death of two of the friends in question, putting an end to their traitorous practices, and the creatures Habaxtal employed about his revenge found out that before the Irish Rising of 98 he had been a friend of Lord Edward Fitzgerald, that he had committed some indiscretions in favour of Irish independence, and that with the help of hired Dublin informers and fresh evidence, he might yet be taken up on a capital charge. Furthermore, he had brought back two transported convicts from Botany Bay before their time and without leave. Ordinarily, I should have dealt with this situation much as you dealt with William Harvey's case. But with such high-placed and influential enmity, I dared not move for fear of making things even worse. Instead, I advised him to withdraw privately to Spain, together with his protégés and his fortune, which was liable to forfeiture on such a charge. This he did, adding his little daughter to the company. Not his wife, who happened to be in Ireland. I believe there were certain difficulties since accommodated. All this, you understand, was before the cruise in the Gulf. Dr. Maturin took part in the expedition? Certainly. Not only was it his duty as the Bellona's surgeon, but he is passionately opposed to slavery. Needham pursed his lips and shrugged. He is also an eminent naturalist, one of our best authorities on comparative anatomy. In more liberal company, Sir Joseph might have spoken of the paper on potters, with particular reference to their anomalous phalanges that Dr. Maturin had read to the Royal Society, and the sensation it had caused among those capable both of hearing what he said and of appreciating the full import of what they heard. In the present circumstances, he carried straight on. This meeting was wholly necessary from departmental and political points of view, and the files available to Needham might be of great and immediate value in spite of the man's limited intelligence. Yet the interview was in no way congenial, and Sir Joseph couldn't wish it prolonged. A few days before the returning squadron reached Bantry Bay, Habaxdal killed himself. Opposition no longer existed, and I at once took the necessary steps, obtaining immediate consent for the pardon. I sent over an express, telling him that all was well and that he might gather his family and wealth as soon as he chose. He came back to England, accompanied by his wife, and they both set off by the shortest route, Mrs. Maturin being subject to the seasickness, with the intention of posting down to the groyne to make arrangements for the transfer of his fortune, all in gold, by the way, to this country, and then of picking up the protégés and the child at Avila. Where is Avila? In Old Castile. 8 days after he left, we had information from one of our best agents that he had been denounced to the Spanish government as the prime mover in the Peruvian conspiracy, in the Peruvian attempt at declaring themselves independent of Spain. Was there any truth in the denunciation? Yes, there was. Oh, cried Needham, deeply impressed. And then, it very nearly succeeded, according to our information. Very nearly indeed. A matter of a few hours and we should have been home, home hands down, but for a silly, busy, prating, enthusiastic fool, a prisoner of war who escaped from Aubrey's ship and ran up and down in Lima calling out that Maturin was a British agent, that the revolution was paid for by English gold. At the last moment, the cry was taken up by the French mission, sent there on the same errand but with inadequate funds, and they made such a noise that the leading general cried off and Maturin had to leave the country. This wretched Dutard reached Spain a little while ago, and they asked us for an explanation. You denied everything, of course. Sir Joseph bowed. But it was clear they didn't believe us. They clapped an embargo on his money in Corona, and they meant to seize him when he went to collect it. I sent warnings by 3 several agents and telegraphed Plymouth for the fastest cutter to take a message to our man in Corona itself. We had a few reports of his passage, chiefly from military intelligence, the last being a dubious account of a wealthy pair with an escort travelling through Aragon in a coach and 4. Then nothing. Nothing whatsoever. All traces lost. And the Aragon report was geographically improbable, since it would have been right off his route. Then again, although Matchalin is a wealthy man, an uncommonly wealthy man, he never gives that appearance, being habitually threadbare and always inconspicuous. Your people have some contacts in Spain that we do not as yet possess, and if they can throw any light whatsoever on the subject, we should be most grateful. I shall, of course, do everything in my power. Many thanks. He's been much on my mind. A pearl of an agent. Totally unmercenary. Polyglot. A natural philosopher with innumerable contacts among the learned abroad. A man with a profession that introduced him everywhere. A physician is welcome everywhere. And a Catholic, which is such a recommendation in the greater part of the world. A Roman and trustworthy? Asked Needham with another worldly look. Yes, sir, said Blaine, touching a private bell under the desk with his foot. And in the very first place I should have said that he utterly abhors all tyranny. Bonaparte's above any. The door opened. Carling glided in, and bending respectfully over Sir Joseph, he said, I do beg your pardon, sir, but the First Lord particularly desires a word. Is it urgent? I'm afraid so, Sir Joseph. Mr. Needham, sir, I must crave your indulgence, said Blaine, rising with something of an effort. But fortunately we've reached a natural term in our most interesting and valuable conversation. May I hope to hear from you in due course? Certainly, sir, without fail. Tomorrow at the latest. Stephen was still in Sir Joseph's mind as he walked back to his house in Shepherd Market. A walk much insisted upon by Dr. Maturin, who distrusted both the colour of Blaine's face and the eminently palpable state of his liver. Stephen was one of the few men Sir Joseph cordially liked. It was true that they had many tastes in common. Music, entomology, the Royal Society, excellent wine, and they both hated Napoleon. But there was also that particular sympathy and mutual respect which transformed such, he hesitated for the word, shared interests, inclinations, traits, characteristics, into something of another order entirely. At the corner of St. James's Street, the usual crossing sweeper was waiting to see him across Piccadilly with a waving broom. Thank you, Charles, he said, handing him his weekly fourpence. On the other side, by the White Horse, a man was carefully extracting a woman from a carriage, a very handsome woman indeed. And as Blaine walked along Half Moon Street, he found that he was reflecting on Stephen's marriage. Stephen had married a woman more handsome by far, the kind of woman Blaine loved to gaze upon, the kind he would have loved to marry had he met her, and had he possessed the courage, the presence, and the fortune. How Maturin, who possessed even less presence, and at that time no fortune whatsoever, had presumed so far, he couldn't tell. Yet, again and again, she'd made him bitterly unhappy, he said inwardly. And as his feet carried him towards his own doorstep, the words, handsome is as handsome does, crossed his mind, although he was very fond of Diana and greatly admired her spirit. Musing, he walked with his head bowed. The three well-worn steps came within his field of vision. He was conscious of a slight form standing at his door itself, and then of Stephen's face smiling down at him. Oh, oh! He cried in a voice more like that of a startled ewe than of the Director of Naval Intelligence. Stephen, your name was in my mouth. You are as welcome as the first Red Admiral in spring. How do you do, my dear sir? How do you do? Walk in, if you please, and tell me how you do. Stephen walked in, shepherded with a surprising amount of fuss. Surprising in so reserved and phlegmatic a man as Sir Joseph, along that familiar corridor to the even more familiar, comfortable, book-lined, turkey-carpeted room in which they had so often sat. A cheerful fire was already burning, and Sir Joseph at once stirred it to a still livelier blaze. Turning, he shook Stephen's hand again. "What may I offer you?" he asked. "A dish of tea?" "Oh, no, you despise tea." "Coffee? A glass of Sillery?" "No." "I will not be importunate. You look wonderfully well, if I may be so personal, wonderfully well. And I'd been seeing you in a Spanish prison, pale, unshaved, thin, ragged, verminous." He felt the force of Stephen's pale, questioning eye and went on. "That reptile Dutour reached Spain and denounced you. Gonzales, who knew something of your activities in Catalonia, believed him, sequestered your treasure in Corunna, and gave orders that you were to be taken up the moment you came to gather it. This I learnt from Wall and other wholly reliable sources a week after you'd left. You cannot imagine the efforts I made to warn you, or the quantities of coca leaves I devoured to keep my wits active. And now, to see you sitting there, apparently perfectly well and quite unmoved, almost makes me feel ill-used, indignant. Though, in parenthesis, I must thank you yet again for those blessed leaves. I have a reliable supply from an apothecary in Greek Street. May I offer you a quid?" "You are very good, but were I to indulge, the insensibility about my pharynx would persist until early supper-time, a meal I particularly wish to enjoy. And then I wish to sleep to-night." A pause, and Blaine said, "I will not be so indiscreet as to ask whether you had other and earlier sources of information." "I had not," said Stephen, whose mind was yet to grasp the full extent and all the implications of Sir Joseph's news. "Faith, I had not. My safety, our safety, depended under Providence, St. Patrick, Stephen the Proto-Martyr, and St. Brendan solely upon my own ineptitude, my own gross ineptitude, I might even say inefficiency. Will I tell you about it?" "If you would be so good," said Blaine, moving his chair closer. "It does me no credit at all, at all. But since you've been to such pains, I owe you an account, however bald and inadequate. We landed on a sweet, calm day, and Diana, having recovered from what slight remains of the seasickness still hung about her, we took coach and travelled westward along the coast. There was a good inn at Laredo, where we ate some hundreds of new-run infant eels, 2 inches long, and took our ease. And when we were arranging our baggage for the next stage in a fine new carriage that was to take us all the way, Diana, a far better traveller than I, a more orderly mind where packing is concerned, suggested that I should make sure that everything was in place for our arrival at Corunna. Proper clothes for waiting on the governor, hair powder, my best wig, and above all, the elaborately signed and countersigned acknowledgement that the Bank of the Holy Ghost and of Commerce had received the specified number of chests containing the stated weight of gold and would deliver it up on the production of this document. Everything was in place. Satin breeches, red-heeled shoes, powder, silver-hilted sword, everything but this infernal piece of paper. I blush to own it," said Maturin, his sallow face in fact changing colour, as a pinkness rose from his lower cheeks to his forehead, disappearing under his wig, a physical bob. "I am ashamed to say it, but I couldn't find the wretched thing." Against all his principles, Blaine cried out, "You'll never tell me you lost the bank's receipt for all that gold, Stephen." "Lost it? I beg your pardon." Stephen shook his head. "I turned over innumerable other sheets, all ornithological notes I had brought for a friend, the Archdeacon of Gihon, and many, many others, turned them again, formed them into heaps, sorted the heaps. Joseph, the tongue of angels couldn't tell you the degree of frustration. And I had not the face to attempt the impossible task of persuading the Holy Ghost and Commerce to yield that treasure on my mere unsupported word. No, indeed, said Blaine, deeply shocked. The dear knows, and you know, that it was, in fact, all for the best, said Stephen, yet I was very near cursing the day. But, however, I didn't quite do so, because in the course of the night an inner voice said, as distinctly as the small beast in the revelation of St. John the Divine, Poor worm, think on Latham. And my mind was at ease directly. I slept until sunrise, waking with the name Latham still in my ears. Latham of the Synopsis? Just so. Immediately before leaving, I had leafed through a magnificently bound copy of the Synopsis, the recent gift of, he was about to say, of Prince William, but changed it to a grateful patient, and went on, a sadly muddled piece of work, I'm afraid, though as laborious as Atkinson. I've no patience with Latham, said Sir Joseph. I should love him as long as I live, indifferent ornithologist though he be. For I knew with a total, and I may add subsequently justified conviction, that my receipt was between the pages of his general synopsis of birds. In the morning, therefore, I saw the mishap as an uncommonly well-disguised blessing. Not quite so much of a blessing as I now know from what you tell me, but a blessing still and all, and a great one. As you know, Diana and her daughter hadn't seen one another for some time. There'd been certain difficulties. Sir Joseph bowed. He was perfectly aware that the child had been thought dumb, mentally deficient, impervious, and that Diana, unable to bear it, had gone away, leaving Bridget in the care of Clarissa Oakes. But an inclination of his head, a general murmur, seemed the best form of response. And although the child is now living in this world and speaking with perfect fluency, it occurred to me that the meeting would be far better, far easier, if everyone were in a coach, bounced together, seeing new things, unknown wonders, strange inns, however bad, curious meals, fresh ways of dressing, always something to remark upon, to cry out at. Furthermore, I'd always wanted to show both of them my Catalonia, and to consult Dr. Liers of Barcelona, that eminent physician. Though, however, he could improve the present Bridget, I cannot tell. So, since for immediate needs I had plenty of money without going to Corona, that wet and dismal town the back of my hand to it and all the thieves it harbours, I sent a well-mounted courier away to Segovia, where Clarissa Oakes, you remember Clarissa Oakes, my dear? Indeed I do, and the invaluable information she gave us all, heavens yes. And in any case, her formal pardon reached my desk today, together with yours and Padine's. Stephen smiled and went on. To Segovia, where Clarissa Oakes and Bridget were staying with my Alarcón cousins by way of a holiday. There we picked them up, and I do assure you, Joseph, that I have never made a better inspired move in my life. Clarissa and Diana had always agreed very well, and after a little shyness, Bridget joined in, so that the coachful could have been heard talking and laughing a furlong off, particularly as Bridget so very often leaned out to call up to Padine behind, desiring him to look at the brindled cow, at the great yoke of oxen, at the three children on one ass, Such weather we had, and such wonders we saw. I showed them the great colony of fulvous vultures beyond Yops, and a distant bear on the slope of the Maladetta. Bee-eaters by the hundred in the sandy banks of the Llobregat, and my own place under the Alberes, where I brought Jack Aubrey out of France in 03. And there I found something that may please you. You know, of course, that in the micaceous schist of those parts, the arbutus is a usual sight, and that therefore Charaxes Jasius, the two-tailed pasha, is not so rare as he is elsewhere in Europe. It was the sight of one sailing by that brought you to mind. Sailing by, yes, indeed. On the few occasions I have seen him, I run with all my might, net outstretched, but all to no avail, and purchased specimens, though very well for comparison and study, are by no means the same thing. You might as well buy your quails and partridges from a game dealer. I was more fortunate. Behind Ricassin, in what I might call my own backyard, I watched one emerging from his chrysalis. I placed a bell jar over him, let him spread his wings, assume his full glory, and then by night carried him in, cut him short with a painless waft, and so put him up for you. Stephen brought a soft packet from his bosom, unwrapped it, and passed a small glass case. After the briefest moment, Blaine's happy, eager look changed. He said, "You'd never make game of me, Stephen. Not on such a subject. Pray look closer. Pray turn them upside down. Pray compare him with those you have." Moving slowly and with backward glances, Sir Joseph moved over to his cabinet, drawer after drawer of beautifully mounted insects. He held his present over the relevant specimens, and slowly, in a voice of wonder, he said, "By God, it is a melanistic Charaxes, a perfect, wholly melanistic Charaxes Jasius." He turned the orthodox butterflies and his new acquisition over and over, holding them to the light and murmuring about the exact repetition of the pattern and the exact reversal. "I never knew it occurred in Charaxes, Stephen. No books, no collection has ever recorded it. Oh, Stephen, what a treasure! No wonder you clapped a bell jar over him. God bless you, my dear friend. You couldn't have made me happier. I shall write a paper on him for the proceedings. Such a paper!" He went slowly back to his chair, privately turning the case in various directions, and his face rosy with contentment. But the recording part of his mind was still intent upon Stephen's account of this idyllic ramble through a variety of landscapes, all more or less torn by recent or even actual warfare. "How I wish I had a better memory for geography," he said. "If we were at the Admiralty, I could follow on a map. But as it is, I cannot understand how you escaped from the raiding parties or foragers of either side, and from the notice of both military intelligence and our people." "It is almost impossible to explain without a chart, since we rarely steered the same course for more than two watches. Dr. Maturin, as a ship's surgeon, was rather fond of using nautical expressions, correct nautical expressions on occasion." And this he repeated with a certain emphasis before going on. "That is to say, we wandered in an unmethodical, even a whimsical fashion, guided by youthful recollections, by the prospect of a noble forest, by side roads leading to the houses of remote friends or cousins. But when we have an enormous atlas before us, I will do my best to retrace our journey. For the now, let me only observe that our path from Laredo to Segovia was far, far south of such dangerous parts as the neighbourhood of Santander or Pampeluna. To be sure, there were the signs of war in many a field, many a devastated village or shattered bridge, and it is true that there was a little trouble from English, Spanish, and Portuguese stragglers on occasion, while once we saw a troop of French hussars pursued into the darkness of the Upper Ebro by a numerous band of dragoons. Were the ladies distressed? Not that I observed. No, on reflection, no, to be sure, said Blaine, who had seen Diana driving a four in hand along the Stockbridge Road and out-galloping the Salisbury Flyer itself to the cheers of the passengers aboard, and who knew that Clarissa had been sent to Botany Bay for blowing a man's head off with a double-barrelled fowling piece. But when we struck north into Catalonia, I was among friends, protected by a network of intelligence. So having consulted dear Dr. Liers, we viewed the estuary, or rather the estuaries of the Ebro, such myriads of flamingos, Joseph, with two spoonbills and a glossy ibis, all in the course of a single picnic, and so took ship from Valencia to Gibraltar, where we changed to the packet. As brilliant a voyage as could be imagined. Diana didn't feel even the least uneasiness, and now we're all at the Grapes together, with Mrs. Broad and the black children I brought from the South Sea, Sarah and Emily. Will you not come and sup with us? You'd enjoy the little girls. They're so pleasant together. They play puss in the corner and hunt the slipper. Ah, indeed. Unhappily, said Sir Joseph, unhappily I'm engaged to supper at Black's. Then let's walk along together. At this time of day, it's the best place in London to find a hackney coach setting down. By all means, said Blaine, but I believe I shall throw a very light greatcoat over my shoulders. There's a certain bite in the evening air. He rang for his man-servant. It was his housekeeper, however, who answered. And a little vexed, he asked, but where's Treacher? I rang for Treacher. He's not back yet, Sir Joseph. Well, never mind. Pray fetch me my very light greatcoat. I'm going to have supper at the club. But, Sir Joseph, the sweetbreads and asparagus, she began, then checked herself. They walked along very companionably, talking mostly about beetles, their almost infinite variety. And passing a house in Arlington Street, Blaine said, that was where Hammersley lived. A very great collector. Did you ever meet him? I believe not. Yet he too was a member. We've had several far-travelled learned members, eminent entomologists. I wish we had more. And speaking of Blacks, have you seen Captain Aubrey? I ran into him as he was leaving the club, and there was just time for him to tell me that all was well at home, that he still had the Bellona now on the Brest blockade, that he'd kept my place aboard her, that they were living at Woolcombe, as handier for Torbay or Plymouth, and should be happy to see us all for as long as ever we chose to give them the pleasure. Vast great house, whole wings empty. He'd just been up for the naval estimates. Must run, not to miss the coach, and so vanished, cleaving the throng. Blaine shook his head. Will you not walk in and take at least a glass of sherry before your puss in the corner? Some added fortitude, Dutch courage, is essentially called for where the ceaseless din of children is concerned. I will not, said Stephen, though I thank you kindly. It's already late for girls of that age, and we must be up early for the journey into the west. Are you away so soon? A little before the dawn itself. Shall I not see you again? Oh, surely. I come up next week for the meeting of the Royal and to see about the lease of our house in Half Moon Street. In the present state of affairs, we cannot possibly afford to keep it up, but just now we mean to go down to the Aubreys and stay with them until a suitable little place can be found in the country. And, of course, I must rejoin my ship. We're selling, or trying to sell, that gaunt, cold, ill-omened barum, which will put us in funds again. And in the meantime, I shall borrow a few thousand from Jack Aubrey. Blaine gave him a quick look. And a few paces on, when they were almost at the door of the club, with members going in and out like bees, he took Stephen's elbow, halted him by the railings, and in a low voice he said, "Do beg your friend to be quiet in the house, Stephen." On naval estimates, he addressed the ministry as though they were a parcel of defaulters. And now that he has most unhappily overcome his diffidence as a new member, he does so in a voice calculated to reach the main topmast head in a hurricane. His friends do so wish he were not in Parliament. Or if he feels he has to be a member, and indeed there are great potential advantages, that he would rarely attend, and then sit mute, voting as he is told. I dread the moment he gives voice against the ministry in his dashing, headstrong way. He's very often in town with a jobbing captain aboard his ship, doing her no good, nor her reputation. Stephen, do take him to sea and keep him there. They were now at the steps leading into Black's. Down them hurried a tall, thin member, pursued by the cry of, "Your Grace! Your Grace!" His Grace turned, and with an anxious look he asked, "Have I done something wrong?" "Your Grace has taken Mr. Wilson's umbrella," said the head porter, walking down to recover it. And now a positive company of members came streaming in from a cockpit over the way, making conversation impossible. "Until next week," cried Stephen. "A safe and prosperous journey, and my dear love to the ladies," replied Sir Joseph, kissing his hand. Captain Aubrey, Commodore no longer, since the appointment lapsed with the dissolution of his squadron and the temporary title with it, and his wife sat at the breakfast table, looking out over the broad grey courtyard of Woolcombe House to the veiled woods and the sky, a somewhat lighter grey, but quite as melancholy. They sat in silence, waiting for the newspaper and the post, but a companionable silence. And as Jack's gaze moved indoors, it paused on Sophie before travelling on to the coffee-pot. She was a tall, gentle, particularly sweet-looking woman, 30-odd, and Jack's rather stern face softened. "How well she's bearing up under all this," he reflected. "She may not have quite Diana's dash, but she's plenty of bottom. Plenty of bottom. A rare Plucton." All this was a spate of litigation arising from Jack's cruise against slave traders in the Gulf of Guinea. When he and his captains were confronted with a stinking vessel crammed with black men and women chained on a low slave deck in that tropical heat, they didn't always pay the very closest attention to the papers that were produced. Above all, since the first 10 alleged protections had proved to be forgeries. Yet genuine protection did exist. Portuguese slavers, for example, could still legally trade south of the line, and if one was found in the northern hemisphere, obviously heading for Cuba, it was difficult to prove that the ship's master hadn't been compelled by stress of weather to put his nose over the equator, or that he didn't intend to steer for Brazil tomorrow, particularly as a cloud of witnesses would swear to the fact. Navigational error, shortage of stores and the like could always be brought forward with a fair appearance of truth. Then again, there were all sorts of legal devices by which the true ownership of the vessel could be disguised or concealed. Companies holding on behalf of other companies and so on, four deep, with the true responsibility for the cargo growing more dubious at each remove. Nor was there any shortage of legal talent to make the most of a wealthy shipowner's case. The day was as still as a day could well be. Extremely damp, and so silent that the dew could be heard dripping right along the front of the house, which an earlier Jack Aubrey, in the fashion of his day, had built facing north. Right along the front, and on either of the somewhat later wings, even to the very end of that on the east, whose ultimate drip fell on a cistern whose leaden voice was part of the captain's very earliest memories. To these, in time, was added the sound of hooves, the high-pitched hooves of a mule approaching. Then an old man's creaking voice and a boy's shrill pipe. This was George Aubrey, the captain's son. And presently he appeared outside the window, smiling, a little cheerful fat boy with his father's bright yellow hair, blue eyes and high colour. Although he didn't encourage them to breakfast with him when he was on shore, Jack was fond of his children, and with an answering smile he walked over to the window. "Good morning, sir," cried George, handing in the Times. "Harding showed me a worry angle in the hedge by Simmons Lee." "Good morning to you, George," said Jack, taking the paper. "I'm amazingly glad about the worry angle. He showed me one, too, just before I went to sea. Remember all the details you could manage, and tell me at dinner." Back in his chair, he opened the pages eagerly, for this was the day when the flag promotion would be announced, and he turned straight to the Gazette. There were the familiar names. The whole list of admirals, that glorious rank, from the most junior rear admirals of the blue, just promoted from the most senior names on the post-captain's list, onwards. All of them, moving steadily up through the ranks and squadrons. Rear admirals of the blue, then of the white, then of the red. Vice-admirals, and then full admirals of the same, and finally, the sailors' apotheosis, admiral of the fleet. The last nine stages of increasing splendour were devoid of suspense, progress being wholly automatic, depending on seniority. No merit, no royal favour even, could advance a man a shadow of an inch. And Nelson died a vice-admiral of the white. Yet Jack read out many of the admirals they knew, or liked, or admired. "Sir Joe will hoist the red at his mizzen. He'll like that. I shall drink him joy of it at dinner. I should like it too. Lord, if I were ever to hoist my own flag, I should keep it to be buried in." He carried on, picking out friends in the squadrons red, white and blue. But just before he reached the really interesting part, the dividing line, the crucial boundary between the top of the post-captain's list and the rear admirals of the blue, Sophie, still much put out by that unfortunate reference to a shroud, said, "I'm glad about dear Sir Joe, and Lady Lepore will be delighted. Yet, after all, surely it's no surprise any more than moving up the dance. And what do you mean, if you were ever to hoist your flag? You're quite near the top of the list, and no one can deny you the right to one." She spoke with the particular emphasis, even vehemence, of those who wish to establish the truth of their words. Although, as a sailor's wife, she knew perfectly well that the Navy list contained 28 superannuated rear admirals, and, even worse, 32 superannuated post-captains. "Of course," said Jack. "That's the usual way. You go up and up like Jacob on his ladder. But with something so important, it'd be courting ill luck to speak of any certainty about it. You mustn't tempt fate. If I were Stephen, I should cross myself whenever I had to mention flag rank. God bless us all. No, they don't usually superannuate post-captains unless they're very old and sick, or very mad and froward, or unless they often refuse service, though I have known it done. No, on the whole, and speaking quite impersonally, you understand, it could be said that men at the head of the post-captain's list may assert a right to a flag at the next promotion of admirals. But that don't mean they have a right to hoist it, let alone do any employment. What happens if they don't like the cut of your jib is that they make you a rear admiral without distinction of squadron. You have a rear admiral's half pay. You have the nominal rank. But you're neither red, white, nor blue. Neither fish, flesh, fowl, nor good red herring. And when sailors call you Admiral, the decent ones look away. The others smile. In the cant phrase, you've been yellowed. But that could never happen to you, Jack, she cried. Not with your fighting record. And you've never refused any service, however disagreeable.
I hope you're right, my dear, said Jack, searching down the column.
Yet I'm afraid it's happened to Captain Willis. John Thornton's not here either. But I think he's accepted a place as commissioner, which puts him out of the running. Craddock's missing too. She came up and looked over his shoulder. So he is, poor soul. Though I never liked him. But there's no mention of without distinction of squadron, and I've never seen it either in any gazette. No. They don't make it public. You just get a letter saying that their lordships do not have it in contemplation and so on. And I'm afraid more and more people are going to get that damned uncomfortable letter. Unless Napoleon wins yet another of those shattering unexpected victories by land all over again, it looks as though this war was pretty nearly over, with the French cleared right out of Spain and Wellington already well into France. Oh, I hope so, said Sophie. So do I, of course. Very good thing, to be sure. No more carnage. But can you imagine the cutthroat struggle for commands in a navy reduced to 3 wherries in a gig? Armageddon'd be nothing to it. No, no. Rather than make things even worse and overcrowd the flag officers' list, they'll superannuate right, left and centre. And the devil take the... They both turned their heads, listening. Hooves again, far off, and sea-growing cries. Give way there! Luff and touch her! That's very well, that's... Easy, she goes, easy, easy! God damn it, blast your horse! This ain't a fucking Derby Stakes! Whenever Captain Aubrey was ashore for any length of time, as for that part of the parliamentary session devoted to the naval estimates, he naturally brought his coxswain, his steward, and one or two followers with him. The first, Barrett Bondon, was a tough, powerful, very able seaman. The virtues of the second, preserved Killick, were less evident. He was a passable seaman and a brilliant silver polisher, but as a personal servant he left much to be desired. Indeed, almost everything. Jack brought them because it was customary for a post-captain to have a minimum of retinue, and Captain Aubrey had the greatest respect for naval customs. Yet they were beings so wholly nautical that they were of very little use to him by land. In the present instance, for example, they were barely capable of inducing a staid old mare, well past mark of mouth and thoroughly accustomed to the road, to carry them and the gig to the post office for the Woolcombe letters without overturning into a ditch or two, or even, in her agitation of mind, losing the way. The voice died away, as the mare, quickening her pace, headed for the familiar stables behind the house. Jack and Sophie sat, waiting. The post had been a matter of dreadful importance ever since the first action for wrongful seizure opened with a broadside of writs, each more injuriously phrased and menacing than the last. In a properly run household, it was the butler's duty, indeed his privilege, to carry in the family's letters, taking them out of the leather bag in which the postmaster at Woolhampton had placed them, considering them back and front, and arranging them on a salver. Woolcombe was still a properly run house, though terribly threatened and managing on the strictest minimum. But its due order was shaken every time the captain's coxswain appeared. He had an unshakable view of his own prerogatives, and since Mnason, the regular hereditary butler, knew that the broken-nosed coxswain had knocked out or otherwise disabled all challengers for the championship of the Mediterranean fleet, he confined himself to verbal complaints, and Bondon carried the salver in, smoothing his hair and buttoning his jacket to do so in style. Jack Aubrey had certain rules, somewhat tainted with superstition, and one of these obliged him to take the nearest letter. Sophie knew no such laws, and she instantly reached over for a cover addressed in a well-known hand and bearing an Ulster postmark. It was from her sister Frances, a young, pretty, and more or less penniless widow, who had turned her big house into a girls' school, where, with the help of their former governess, she was educating the Aubrey twins, Charlotte and Fanny, among a score or so of others. She enclosed two fairly creditable letters from them, written on hot-pressed pink paper. Sophie, a deeply affectionate soul, read them twice, and with such pleasure that a tear dimmed her eye. She then put them in her lap and picked another from the array. A singularly wretched choice that brought tears of quite another kind, or almost brought them, for by now she'd had a good deal of practice at mastering the actual flow. Each put down a letter. Each looked at the other. "What news, my dear?" asked Jack. Her back was to the light, and he didn't see how distressed she was. "Good news from Frankie and the girls," she said. And he heard the tremble. "But Cluttons say that with the times so bad and the cost of removing all the inscriptions so high, they're afraid they cannot offer more than the melting pot price for the Jamaica service." Jack nodded, but said nothing. "What was yours?" she went on. For they dealt with these things on an equal footing, with no concealment on either side, almost no concessions. "It was from Lawrence," he said. "Leave to appeal has been refused." She digested this. It was the wreck of all their cherished, accumulated hopes as far as that particular case was concerned. "We shall have to sell Ashgrove," she said after a pause. "The creditors will not wait." Jack cast her a loving glance. What she said was true. The only evident solution since Woolcombe was entailed. Yet it was scarcely one that he could have proposed. Ashgrove was her own, and could neither be sold nor mortgaged by him. Very much her own, and even legally so by settlement. A rambling house they'd planned together piece by piece, but of course carried out almost entirely by her, with Jack being so long at sea. Although quite by itself, in its own woods, it was a wonderfully convenient house for a naval officer, within sight of Portsmouth, and at present it was let to an admiral who'd done very well out of prize money, and who'd thrown out many a hint about buying it. "May I see the girls' letters?" he asked. And when he'd read them, he said, "I'm afraid you miss them cruelly. But it is really much better that they should be with Frankie. There's nothing worse for children than a house with lawsuits hanging over it. Threats they don't really understand. Universe crumbling. Parents nearly always sad or cross. Perpetually anxious." He spoke from intimate knowledge, since it was his father's litigious propensities even more than his other faults of character that had made Jack's mother's short life so unhappy, and that had at times so oppressed his naturally cheerful boyhood, that even now this house cast a gloom upon his spirits. He was never cordially happy there, except in the parts behind, the stable courts, the walled garden, and the far garden with its grotto. But I think George is still too young to feel it. In any case, we don't quarrel. "No, my dear," she said, looking at him kindly. "But he is lonely, poor lamb. Shall we look through the rest? Perhaps we're both missing heirs." No sudden fortune. But Jack's face lit with much the same light as he turned the last letter of his undistinguished pile. "Why, this is Stephen," he exclaimed, breaking the seal. By God, they'll be here today. Stephen, Diana, Clarissa Oakes, Bridget, Paddy, the whole shooting match. What joy! Listen, sweetheart. My dear Jack, may I indeed inflict myself, all my women, and a numerous band of followers upon you indefinitely. Diana, who sends her love, says it is a monstrous imposition, above all with no notice, but I reassure her, saying it was an understood thing between us. We'd met at Black's, you'd stress the empty immensities of your palatial home. And I wouldn't wound you for the world, as I must by taking hired lodgings until a suitable house can be found. My dear, what's amiss? Are you delighted? Oh, indeed I am. I love Stephen. I'm fond of my cousin. I'm as delighted as a woman can be who has nothing ready for a single guest, let alone a regiment, including that Mrs. Oakes. Nothing whatsoever. You would have yesterday's beefsteak pudding again for dinner, and there's nothing else in the house. We shall have to put them in the east wing. There's room enough there, God knows, but it's not been turned out. It hasn't been touched since Michaelmas. She started up, gathering her wits and saying, I shall never be ready in time. Hurried from the room. She was not what she called ready when the coach and four, driven in great style by Diana, rolled in a smooth curve across the courtyard and pulled up exactly at the foot of the steps, discharging an improbable number of people. But she was at the open, welcoming door, pale but properly dressed, conscious that the main rooms of the East Wing were as spotless as the decks of a man-of-war, and cleaned in much the same hearty fashion that an unspeakably well-timed gift of venison ensured their dinner, and that the reprieved Jamaica service, the West India merchant's expression of thanks to Captain Aubrey for ridding them of privateers, would lay it out in splendour. She received them prettily, kissing Diana and Bridget, dropping that Mrs. Oakes quite a deep curtsy, and hoping that she saw her well, and then leading them into the blue parlour to drink tea while their baggage was carried away, and whilst Jack, Stephen, an aged groom and a stable boy put the splendid coach and its team of bays in stable and coach house. "Why, Diana," called Jack in his strong voice, coming in and brushing the oat dust from his coat, "where did you get your magnificent cattle?" "I borrowed them from my cousin Chumley," said she. "We met him in Bath, glum as a gibcat, with a gouty toe that nailed him to his chair. Said the horses were bursting for want of exercise. It made him low in his spirits. So I offered to drive them down here. He'll send his coachman to take them back on Thursday."
"He must have an amazing opinion of your powers," said Jack. "I once asked him to lend me a perfectly ordinary dog-cart with a perfectly ordinary animal to pull it just for an hour or so, and he wouldn't."
"Jack," said Diana, smiling, "a thousand repartees come to mind, each wittier than the last, but I shall not utter a single one. This is a very striking case of magnanimity in a poor, weak woman who rarely thinks of any repartee until it is far too late to produce it. Admiral Rodham says that for ship handling, Jack hasn't his equal in the entire service," said Sophie. Diana looked down without even a hidden smile. And in the silence that followed, Stephen watched George and Bridget. The little boy walked round and round her, gazing. Sometimes she smiled at him, but sometimes she turned away her head. Eventually he came right up to her, offered her the best part of a biscuit, and said, "Should not you like to see my dormouse? He's a prodigious fine dormouse, and will let you touch him." "Off you please," she said, jumping up at once. "Stephen, Diana, dear Mrs. Oakes," said Jack, "I don't believe you've any of you been here before. Should you like to see the house? The library's rather good, and the justice room, though I'm afraid much of the rest was modernised a few years ago." "Oh, my dear," cried Sophie, aware of the horrors stuffed into both and they totally unswept. "The light's quite gone, and you really cannot see the panelling when the light's quite gone. Besides, dinner's almost ready, and you must certainly change that disreputable old rat-catcher's coat.